and we'd love just to welcome you to Corps Volunteer Training. It's a program created to help all of CCL supporters, especially our newer volunteers, connect with each other around the larger world and empower us to achieve our larger goals for climate advocacy. This week's essential topic is on the economics of carbon fee and dividend policies, and I'm your host, Brett Cease. Thank you for joining us. If we've done our job well, after the end of tonight's training, you're going to walk away with the following three learning goals. You're going to have the chance to understand the rationale for the three legs of CCL's flagship policy, the carbon fee and dividend. You're going to have a chance to really start describing each of those legs in your own words and how it would function within our country. And you'll also start to address the economic issues related to each leg that is often raised by others that have questions and concerns with this policy. And to help get us through tonight's training, we have an esteemed speaker. We have the wonderful Robert Archer, who's an economist by training with a BA from Yale and a master's from the University of Pittsburgh. Bob is a former Peace Corps volunteer and worked on energy reform and regulatory development, as well as energy efficiency throughout Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, South and Southeast Asia, with USAID, the Agency for International Development, and he comes to us tonight with over 30 years of experience working on economic policy for national and DC interests. And he's now serving as the co-chair or the lead of CCL's Economics Policy Network Action Team. And I can let Bob speak more to that team as he presents tonight. But with that, just know that tonight's agenda is going to be really straightforward. After a short introduction about the general public perception about carbon taxes, Bob will give us the why or the rationale for each element of CCL's three-part policy, you know, how it works, the nuts and bolts, and finally the economic issues where there is often congressional concern. So the last thing I'll say before getting out of the way is, as you listen tonight, I invite you to do two things with any questions that you have. Write them down if you still have any about the policy that you're hoping that we cover. And as you listen, write down one or two connections you learned that you look forward to incorporating into your own elevator pitch about the Energy Innovation Act or carbon fee and dividend policies in general. So with that, though, the floor is yours, Bob. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, and we really look forward to sitting down and listening and learning more.
Thank you, Brett. Good evening. I want to lead off with two slides to provide context. First, the challenge is global. There are billions of individuals, millions of firms, thousands of governments, hundreds of nations, and for them to take action, they're going to have incentives. We can raise the price of goods and services that are carbon intensive. The policies the U.S. puts in place must be workable in developing countries where most climate emissions occur. The second slide shows people's concerns about a carbon fee. A synthesis of 26 studies was done to identify how to make carbon fees more acceptable. It showed four main concerns that people have. Look at the first three as a group: the personal cost, concern about the low income impact, and the mistrust that governments want revenues and not emissions reduced. The beauty of the CCL policy is that these three are all addressed by the equitable dividend. The study found that number four, the lack of understanding that a carbon fee reduces emissions, leads people to favor spending revenues on clean energy projects instead of a carbon dividend, which hurts the low and middle income households. The good news is that when people understand that the fee reduces emissions, the dividend becomes the preference over clean energy expenditures. So we in CCL need to communicate that the dividend is effective and revenues should protect low-income households. Let's start with the basic economics underpinning the fee in the CCL policy. Why a fee? You raise the price of fossil fuels and the demand goes down and emissions go down. This connection is not sufficiently understood or accepted. Our climate problem is due to a major market failure, resulting in what are called negative external costs. When a factory dumps its pollution, such as CO2, in the air and water, the cost falls on us, not them. So there's no incentive for the polluter to change. Here's where the polluter pays principle applies. CCL's carbon fee puts a cost back on the cause of the pollution, fossil fuels. That market impact is one factor. To date, the focus has been mostly on the power of the fee to reduce emissions. There's a second and important impact, the power to accelerate clean energy innovation. One point of view, which you may have heard if you listened to the Energy and Commerce Committee hearings on climate change, is that R&D is all we need, no carbon fee. Such a view ignores the history of oil and gas. They also continue to innovate. A widely held view among academics, industry, and innovators is that a carbon fee will accelerate innovation and speed market adoption by providing strong incentives and by making fossil fuels more expensive. You can see the quote here from Nobel economist Paul Romer. His view reflects CCL's policy of starting low and escalating the fee. The fee starts at $15 a ton, CO2, and rises $10 each year, or $15 if the emissions targets are met. Most other proposals introduced in Congress start higher and escalate slower. Take note that the Energy Innovation Act that we are supporting will raise over $3 trillion over a decade, which is even greater than the corporate income taxes. Why this rising fee? Any carbon pricing policy won't do. The great power of CCL's policy is a predictable rising price. It sends a powerful economy-wide signal for investment and innovation. Unlike regulation or cap and trade, which have not provided the trajectory, predictability, or environmental certainty as academic theory contends. Why aren't carbon prices higher around the world? Politicians are wary because their countries do not have households' dividends, which protects households, or border carbon adjustment to keep their industry on a level playing field. Starting slow and escalating avoids economic shock and that early potential political backlash. It allows planning and economic adjustment by industry, utilities, and households, and provides that provides a clear long-term signal to get the largest household behavior response. It's called tax salience. And what is tax salience? It's a field of economic research that shows that people are more likely to change their behavior in response to a highly visible and highly salient tax compared to what happens with traditional market swings in prices like gasoline. Several other reasons for a carbon fee versus cap and trade and regulation, including simplicity, transparency, efficiency, effectiveness, administrative ease, and it is a good fee fit for developing countries with the problems they have of institutional weakness and serious corruption. The question may come up, isn't a fee the same as a tax? A fee is an appropriate term. It's commonly used for environmental programs that assign costs to pollution activities. For example, you dump your garbage in the street, a fee of pickup is often imposed. Maybe the best reason came from George Shultz, Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State, and a CCL Advisory Board member, who told CCL it's not a tax if the government doesn't keep the money. How is the fee administered? Carbon fee and dividend can use existing IRS and Treasury Department procedures and avoid creating new bureaucracies and minimize the risk of abuse and corruption. And where is it applied? It's applied upstream, as close as possible to the mine, well, and point of importation. For coal, the fee could be imposed at the mine or approximately 500 coal preparation plants. There is already an existing IRS excise form, tax form 720. Simply adding a line to that would work. For oil and gas, a fee can be placed at approximately 140 refineries and at the 500 natural gas processing plants. The bottom line is, it is manageable. The fee impact on emissions is significant. Stanford Energy Modeling Forum and many others forecast reductions of 26 to 47% by 2030, exceeding Paris and former clean power plan targets. The REMI study shows a decline of over 50% in 20 years. Household energy costs. What's the impact? These costs will rise about 5 to 10% with the initial $15 a ton fee. This will stimulate awareness and initiation of changed behavior without economic shock and political backlash. The average U.S. home energy bill is about $2,060 a year. A 10% increase is about $200. The first year dividend will be approximately $750 for a family of four. So the rising cost will be more than covered. We've heard the narrative that a carbon tax is a job and economy killer. To date, we've depended upon the climate economic forecasting models that I mentioned to refute this. That's changed. Gilbert Metcalf, a Tufts University professor and new CCL advisory board member, along with James Stack of Harvard, recently published their research on the impact of the carbon tax in 31 European countries on economic growth and jobs. And the results are very, very encouraging. Carbon taxes have had no negative effect on GDP growth or employment, and may be slightly positive in some cases. In other words, there is no basis for the view that carbon taxes kill growth or jobs. So I give a shout out to Gilbert Metcalf's book, Paying for Pollution, Why Carbon Tax is Good for America. Very readable book. So there are five main takeaways. I'd say economic impact takeaways. First, the fee is effective. Second, innovation will take off. Third, the health benefits, local pollution reduction, and other co-benefits not captured in the modeling will be significant. Fourth, the economy will continue to grow just fine. And fifth, the dividend is the most equitable policy. Here's an example of the impact of a carbon fee. The United Kingdom imposed a carbon tax, which they call a carbon price floor, on coal and gas for power generation, which caused a 90% decline in coal use from 2014 to 2017. The UK imposed it on top of the European Union cap and trade program, which was stagnant at about $5 to $10 a ton from 2012 to 2014. There are several significant misunderstandings about the fee and dividend policy, and I'll address just one that comes up I see periodically. Some groups hold the view that industry will pass on all the carbon fee to consumers and continue their business as usual polluting. That's not the case. In fact, the carbon fee affects all industry, businesses, governments, utilities, consumers, some greatly, some less so. Billions of investment and consumption decisions are affected each day. Most industries have to absorb some of the rising energy input costs. A recent study showed that selected industries pass on 25 to 75% of fossil energy costs to consumers, depending upon the industry's competitive position, market power, and availability of consumer alternatives. In addition, industry also shifts some of the burden back up to fossil fuel suppliers by switching to clean energy options. The dividend. Let's move to the second leg, household dividend or carbon dividend, as it's sometimes called. The dividend consists of a full share for up to two adults, half shares for children up to age 18. A family of four will get about $2,000 a year in year three, over $3,000 a year in year five, and approximately $4,000 a year in year 10, and it peaks at about $4,450 in year 12, based on the CCL forecasts. Why do we do this? Everyone has a view on the use of the large revenues. So why a household dividend? There are two big reasons. The dividend is most equitable of all the policies and programs. Also, it brings long-term policy viability. People will like it and advocate for continuity of the fee, and it pumps money into the economy at the consumer level. This is a Department of Treasury table that shows that the bottom two-thirds of households generally break even or come out ahead. Their dividend equals or exceeds the increased cost of energy and products. It disproportionately benefits lower income households. What about other ways to use the revenues and their equity impacts? Tax swaps. The option of using tax cuts to offset the revenue from the fee through payroll or personal or corporate tax cuts generally will mean the benefits disproportionately accrue to higher income households. Now I'll discuss the impact of using revenues for clean energy programs at the end. Let me show you what happened in British Columbia. They put in place a revenue-neutral carbon tax in 2008, and it's an outstanding program. It reduced emissions. It's revenue-neutral at the start, mostly through corporate and personal tax cuts, not a fee, a dividend, I mean. Polling support for it rose, and it served as a model for the nationwide Canadian revenue-neutral carbon tax that they put in place last year. However, a key lesson learned is that the tax swap approach to revenue neutrality can break down. Part of the 2008 across-the-board tax cuts were steered in 2013 to the favored film industry. In other words, politicians picking winners. Should also note that revenue neutrality was recently dropped by the center-left and Green parties following the 2017 elections so they could spend funds on clean energy projects. They had done it through the tax swap again and not through the whole dividend approach. The administration of the dividend, basically, I'm not going to read this, using the existing procedures that are in place, plus a new form for those who don't submit tax forms. Think about a city. Energy costs are going to go up for them. And where does that impact? Mostly buildings and their fleet of transportations, buses, police, fire, etc. Increases the incentive for greater efficiency. The dividends mean there's going to be greater spending and a little bit more municipal tax revenue. Now, the municipal options, I'm fairly optimistic. There are a lot of local, federal, and state programs that relate to municipal energy efficiency, et cetera, for years. Those are going to be expanded. There'll be greater interaction among municipalities. There is already a lot going on at local, city, and state levels, as you know. Public-private partnerships. For energy efficiency, there's no need for a municipality to spend money on efficiency measures for their buildings, for example. There are what are called energy service companies, ESCOs, that do this all the time. Under performance contracting and sometimes. So I'm reasonably confident municipalities are going to make that adjustment. and they need to make changes, and they have some flexibility in tax revenues to make those investments if they cannot get the private sector or if there's not a green bank or other option. The third leg, the border carbon adjustment, I think is almost a must-have feature to succeed on a global basis, and it's probably the least discussed. You will begin to see more in the news on the Europeans who are starting to consider this as part of their broader climate program. A border carbon adjustment is two things. It's a tariff, basically a tax, placed on goods imported from, or a rebate on goods exported to countries without an equivalent price on carbon. The tariff and rebate are based upon the carbon content of the goods imported and exported. The terms duties, tariffs, levies are often used interchangeably. Let's use Brazil as an example and assume the U.S. has a carbon fee and Brazil doesn't. So the adjustment has two parts, a tariff on goods from Brazil, where there's no equivalent price on carbon, and a rebate on U.S. exports to Brazil. A Brazilian firm with no carbon fee would have an unfair advantage over a U.S. competitor. They can export to the U.S. and undercut the U.S. firm that has higher costs due to the fee. So we impose a tariff on the Brazilian import to level the playing field. When a U.S. company tries to export to Brazil, it won't be competitive. So a rebate is paid to the U.S. company based on the carbon content of its exported product. If Brazil establishes its own comparable carbon fee, then there are no carbon duties or rebates either way. So why do we do this? As previously mentioned, the household dividend addresses the fairness issue for households. The border carbon adjustment addresses a fairness issue for industry. It's critical to avoid adverse industry impacts that could come from countries without a carbon fee. The CCL talking point on this is it removes any incentive for U.S. industries to move to countries without a comparable carbon fee. It avoids exporting pollution, or in economic terms, it avoids leakage. So which industries are at risk? Those that are using a lot of energy and facing international competition. There's a term for industries that use a lot of fossil energy. A lot is defined as 5% or more production cost and are exposed to trade competition. That means 15% of their product is traded. That term is energy intensive trade exposed, EITE. Generally, there's not much harm at low carbon prices at $10 to $15 a ton, but I'll give you a real world example of a rising carbon tax and no border adjustment. It's a case of British Columbia greenhouses, I mean flowers and vegetables. They suffered competitively at $24 a ton in 2012 and were exempted. California and Mexican greenhouses undercut them because they had no similar carbon price. Keep in mind, the impact was in a Canadian province that could not impose a border adjustment, which is a national mechanism. Less than 10% of industries fall into this EITE category. Most industry energy costs average about 2% of production of their total production cost or less. A $25 a ton carbon tax would increase the production cost in electric utilities up to 20%, cement, petrochemicals about 10%, and aluminum, iron and steel, lime, gypsum, fertilizer, paper about 5%. So that gives you a kind of a feel for what the impact would be. Plenty of incentive to switch out new innovation and efficiency. There's a carrot and stick effect for getting countries to adopt this. The firms in free rider countries such as Brazil, with no carbon price, are subject to the U.S. border adjustment. That's the stick. And the countries are incentivized to establish their own carbon price so their firms can avoid the U.S. border adjustment. Who administers this? Again, existing institutions administer the process: the Department of Commerce, International Trade Administration, Customs and Border Protection. The funds are separate. They're collected, not part of the carbon fee on CO2, and the funds cover administration costs. The U.S. imports more goods than it exports, so the funds are going to build up over time. This is an issue that comes up periodically. Is it going to be legal? I'm not going to go into the details of the World Trade Organization and General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, but just mention the next slide, which is Article 20. This article allows discriminatory practice for environmental reasons. First, if it's necessary to protect human, animal, or plant life or health. And second, relating to the conservation of exhaustible natural resources. And if you read the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, the preamble includes exactly this language. CCL is working toward a national carbon fee. Climate change is global. So the U.S. policy must be one that addresses the free rider problem, incentivizes countries to participate, and is a good fit for developing countries with weak institutions, corruption, and income inequality. The CCL policy meets these requirements. How do you get to a global agreement? It's not going to be a massive global treaty with 200 countries signing. Maybe the most pragmatic and promising path to harmonizing global pricing is a multilateral carbon pricing agreement among a subset of nations. For example, the US, Canada, Europe, China, and India could start a club with a border carbon adjustment around that club, which would incentivize others to join. The Paris Agreement is based on ambition, has no enforcement, and is unlikely to achieve the necessary reductions. So let me summarize before I touch on a couple points regarding regulation and cap and trade. In summary, the fee works. Fuel prices go up, demand and emissions down. Steady rising price affects all sectors and innovation, and the economic impact will essentially be neutral. With regard to the revenue use, the dividend's the most equitable, builds constituency support, and the alternatives of tax swaps and clean energy expenditures put burdens on lower incomes. The border carbon adjustment addresses unfair foreign competition. Free rider countries have the incentive to adopt the fee, and it incentivizes a global carbon pricing harmonization. Some brief comments here on regulation and cap and trade. CCL volunteers will increasingly be asked, why not regulations and subsidies or cap and trade? Experience shows the following. Subsidies have been inequitable. Very extensive University of California, Berkeley analysis on that. And regulations cost more and are less effective, as described in the recent International Monetary Fund analysis titled How to Mitigate Climate Change. How about using the fees for clean energy subsidies instead of a household dividend? Using the revenues from the carbon fee for clean energy subsidies has two equity downsides. First, the households don't get the dividend. And second, clean energy subsidies, based on experience, go disproportionately to higher income households. Only 10% of the benefits went to the bottom 60% of households. The upper 20% of households received 60% of the benefits of the tax subsidies. The most inequitable tax credits were for electric vehicles, where the upper 20% got 90% of the subsidies. The recent International Monetary Fund analysis showed the two approaches, regulation and a combination of regulation and cap and trade, are more costly by 50 to 100% and 20 to 40% respectively, and they achieve less emissions reduction. So this is really the summary slide. The central message is that the fee and dividend is the foundational policy that is primary and essential. Truly complementary regulations and subsidies can augment. So what is the sound role for regulation and subsidies? Some experts, including the Canadians, suggest the following guideline for determining when subsidies and regulations are justified. First, where a carbon fee does not impact a sector's emissions at all. For example, enteric fermentation, cow burps, soil carbon sequestration. Second, where the fee doesn't impact a sector sufficiently, such as rental housing, where there's a split in the incentives between landlord and tenant. Then complementary regulation would be justified, such as housing codes and efficiency programs. I think this discussion is going to pick up in this year ahead of us. Carbon fee, regulations, and cap and trade.
Bob, so thank you so much, obviously, for completing all three of the areas of review. And just as a quick announcement for anyone interested, this is how to reach out and connect with Bob, participate in the Economics Policy Network forum that he runs, and also ask any additional questions if you didn't get anything answered tonight to your level of satisfaction. And given it's the top of the hour, I'd love to just end tonight by unmuting all lines and being energized by all of us that made time to be a part of this training. So please join me in thanking Bob for his time tonight and everyone's insights, and we look forward to working together and all ahead with everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Brett.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.